The New York Times, December 13, 1941. 2,541 Axis aliens now in custody. Biddle says list includes 1,370 Japanese, 1,002 Germans, and 169 Italians. Special to the New York Times. Washington, December 12th. Up to Thursday night, the Justice Department had arrested 2,541 German, Japanese, and Italian citizens in the roundup of dangerous aliens which got underway with the outbreak of war between Japan and the United States, Attorney General Francis Biddle said tonight. Of these, 1,002 are Germans, 1,370 Japanese, and 169 Italians. Mr. Biddle emphasized that although they were regarded as, quote, dangerous to the peace and safety of the nation, end quote, Axis subjects under arrest, quote, represented only a small fraction of the more than 1,100,000 Axis nationals residing in the United States. Arrests were limited to persons whose activities have been under investigation by the FBI for some time, said Mr. Biddle. Aides declared that none of the prisoners would be interned throughout the war except where there is, quote, strong reason to fear for the internal security of the United States, end quote. The Justice Department issued a warning that any Japanese, German, or Italian citizen found in possession of a camera, regardless of the use to which it was put, faced loss of his equipment and possible detention. Axis citizens already had been ordered not to make airplane flights of any kind. 26 more aliens taken here. The roundup of potential saboteurs, spies, and enemy aliens here brought in 26 more prisoners yesterday. 16 were German, 6 Japanese, and 5 Italian. Those arrested yesterday also were taken to Ellis Island and turned over to agents of the Bureau of Immigration and Naturalization. As usual, Federal Bureau of Investigation officials refused to comment. William H. Marshall, Assistant Director of Immigration and Naturalization, said that 553 enemy aliens have been rounded up since Sunday. The figures included those seized in places adjacent to New York City. All enemy aliens were barred by the Civil Aeronautics Authority from riding in commercial, government, or private airplanes. The State Labor Department pointed out that enemy aliens were not entitled to receive unemployment insurance, as the law provides that payments can be made only to persons, quote, available for work, end quote. The large plaque in front of the Italian building, 626 Fifth Avenue, was covered yesterday. September 12, 1944. Dear Frida, thank you for sending the clippings. Forgive me for doubting you. This is terrifying news and not well known in these parts. If nothing on earth is new, these howlers are the proof. People will be made afraid at any cost. Your Insolito remains a muddled assembly of two nations, settled for now in the house of his father, puzzling over its construction. By day, we whistle the Internationale and reach right across the world to our comrades. My neighbor knits stockings for the orphans of Moscow. But by night, the neighborhood bolts its doors and looks beneath the beds for an alien menace. Yet, I stake a claim. I am here, for I must be somewhere. But only as a child, it seems, struggling to understand what every wife and gentleman passing on the street seems to know by rote, whom to love, whom to castigate. The only certainty in my own household is the novel is finished. I feel a peculiar sadness, like missing a lively, quarrelsome friend who has ended his long visit. These days I purse my lips at the mirror and wonder how it is that other men find first-class reasons to shave, change out of pajamas, and leave the house practically every day. Your friend Mr. Morrison recommended an editor who sheds a glimmer of interest in looking at the thing. His response has forced me outdoors 3 days in a row, blinking like an owl in search of an envelope or packaging to carry the manuscript to New York. This effort may take longer than writing the book. Stationer's stores no longer have even enough paper for the standard sign declaring their product has gone to the front. The editor may be spared his trouble due to the paper shortage. Probably the manuscript itself should be heaved over in the next paper drive as ballast for a warship. I send you two clippings in return from earlier in the summer. Our town's newspaper is rationed to twice weekly editions, but this article merited precious fiber. Note the date, our shared birthday. You'll remember I wrote you about this beetle. The other page I tore from a respectable magazine, Life, how comprehensive. Enclosed mainly for its spectacular photograph. Like Cortez, I report back to my queen on a new world wondrous strange. Feliz cumpleaños, my friend. From America, where we make do with nothing new. Abrazos, Soli. Life Magazine, July 17, 1944. Japanese Beetle, Voracious, Libidinous, Prolific, by Anthony Standen. Japanese beetles, unlike the Japanese, are without guile. There are, however, many parallels between the two. Both are small but very numerous and prolific, as well as voracious, greedy, and devouring. Both have single-track minds. Both are inscrutable, the beetles particularly, for no one can say why they should be attracted by yellow when most of their food is green, nor why they rush avidly to geraniums. The smell of geraniums is used to bait the traps, when geraniums are poisonous to them. The beetles, however, are firmly settled on our middle Atlantic coast, where they chew up apples, peaches, grapes, roses, pasture grass, and other useful or agreeable vegetable matter to the tune of $7 million every year, and threaten to become rampant over the greater part of the entire country. Long ago we declared war on them, and though we have little chance of total victory, which would mean exterminating every single beetle on our shores, we may hope to achieve a more limited success, with the insects so harassed and persecuted that their numbers would be kept within decency's limit, although their character would never be changed. The Asheville Trumpet, July 6, 1944. Kamikaze Peril Reaches Asheville, by Carl Nicholas. They are small, crafty, and breed unceasingly. They are driven to fly viciously into their targets, creating immense destruction. The Japanese beetle has moved down our coast and arrived at our very door. These odd-looking green insects pose a threat to plant life and domestic tranquility alike. "They fly all over my washing," said Mrs. Jimmy Hyder, a housewife recently sighted on Charlotte Street mounting her offensive. Sons Harold and Alter led the infantry with badminton rackets, and Mrs. Hyder followed with the pump atomizer, dousing the battlefield with insecticide. Weekly sprayings may tip the balance against the enemy, but Mrs. Hyder complains, "They'll keep on flying into you for no good reason, down to the last one." She warned other victory gardeners to expect heavy losses from the enemy this year, especially in the tomatoes and runner beans. Scientists call the greedy beast Popillia japonica. The Agriculture Department believes they first sneaked into the country near New Jersey some years prior to Pearl Harbor, concealed in a crate of fruit. The sly grubs hide underground in winter, emerging famished and keen to ply their destruction in the warmer months. Their fiendish campaign has now reached the Western Carolinas, spoiling orchards worth many $1,000s. Wives and gardeners beware. Though badminton rackets fly on Charlotte Street, Mr. Wick Benson of the County Extension Service says no weapons yet devised have been found to stop this Japanese invasion. Mr. Lincoln Barnes, Editor. Stratford and Sons Publishers, New York, December 11th, 1944. Dear Mr. Barnes, The sum you have proposed is overwhelmingly generous. The changes you suggest in the story will render it much improved. However, I'm not able to consult the pages you mentioned, as the book rests entirely in your hands. You have the only copy. The envelope also may be the sole issue of its litter. Paper remains scarce here. Any shortages in supply lines at the German Bulge were not due to failure of enthusiasm for the paper and scrap drives in Asheville, North Carolina. Thus, it would be useful to have the manuscript returned for corrections at your convenience. Your letter made reference to my secretary typist, to whom you plan to forward more notations. Be assured, the secretary typist will be in intimate contact with the author, the telephone receptionist, cook, and housekeeper, as we all presently inhabit the same $4 shoes. With clothing ration coupons as they are, is a useful arrangement. Gratefully, Harrison W. Shepherd. December 21st. Stalin, 65 years old today. A panting reporter on the radio said he is the Russian Tom Paine rolled together with Paul Bunyan. Lev would now be 64, but isn't. Revolutions are constantly reborn, he used to say, and men like Stalin never die. February 1st. Tonight's news. The Allies broke open the dikes along the Netherlands coast, letting in the sea and drowning thousands of German soldiers in the flood. Like the Azteca, opening dikes to drown Cortez and his men on the shores of Lake Tenochtitlan. But fiction is nonsense. The war is real. Tomorrow, the farmers of Walcheren will wake up to see a tide standing over their crops, the floating corpses of their cattle, every tree in the land scalded dead by the salt on its roots. The glory of war is so frequently disappointing. Too much solitude here, pent up with ghosts, and nowhere to go to escape them. The man in the street selling ice from a truck today had a pick, nearly like the one that murdered Lev. This was the month he dreaded most. Its visitations. February 10th. A better day. The manuscript set aside a while in favor of honest work, as Lev would call it. Painted the dining room, the wainscot between the battens. Wore surplus paint, but a decent color, flannel gray. The neighbor kindly donated an old dining table she doesn't use and a son's Saturday help for the painting. A regular Tom Sawyer. Paid him 2 bits, but suspect he'd rather have had the dead rat and string to swing it with. April 5th, 1945. Dear Frida, your letter was welcome, even if it didn't carry much good news. It is so much better to think of you stomping down the street with skirts roiling, not in a wheelchair. This is a hateful revision. You and Diego should be marching with banners in Paseo de la Reforma this week, protesting the compromises of the Chapultepec Conference. We are much less in the news here than Mexico City, but our headlines may entertain. Production lines at Asheville Casket Company have gone idle today, dead silent, as workers go on strike, flouting their war duties, pending negotiations between management and the upholsterers' union. Next, the writer, William Sidney Porter, or what is left of him, may be dug up from the cemetery in this very neighborhood, for relocation to Greensboro. The city of Asheville has leveled a protest, believing Mr. Porter to be comfortable where he is. The courts will decide. One hopes that no reupholstering will be required at this time. Admiral Halsey came to the Grove Park for some sport hunting. Finally, a story involving no death. And fashion is alive. Lily Daché has worked out how to make civilian Easter bonnets from 76,000 whack hats discarded by the army in favor of the cloth overseas cap. Much on display here last Sunday. You would like gringo Easter. Every woman, even the grayest little pigeon, finds the courage to be a Frida for the day. Not much personal news. The wisteria vines that climb the sides of my house and twine from the eaves are in full purple bloom, the color of jacaranda. Do you ever hear from Van? A question asked, but truly no answer is wanted. A French instructor here at the teacher's college, a particular Miss Atwood, has lately kept up a long campaign to be taken to the movies. With all presentable men at the front, she feels that a fellow should accept his duty to take a girl to see the picture of Dorian Gray. The idea of a crowded theater makes me shudder. Sometimes leaving the house at all becomes a frightful thing. I carry an inexplicable dread inside that never completely abates. But Miss Atwood would not be refused. Heard Hatfield made a gratifying Dorian, despite his treachery toward Sybil Vane and Gladys Halward. Duty seems fulfilled, all quiet on the Atwood front this week. At the end of term, the teacher's college will close. Your language will cease to be maligned by the Carolina tongue. Its only advocate in Asheville will happily stay home in his vine-covered cottage, as his former pupils turn to parachute packing and the like. These girls are so much like Mother, with their gum-cracking confidence and feral vocabularies. Holy Joe! Oh, nausea! He's ooly-drooly! But Mother would be old by now, nearly 50. How she would wail over that if she were still here. Probably it's a charity that she is not. Last item. The book is to be published late this year by Stratford & Sons Publishers, New York. The editor, Mr. Barnes, confirmed it today. He wants it titled Vassals of Majesty, which is silly, as the characters are vassals of cupiditas and greed. The original title was meant to be 10 Leagues from Where We Sleep, as it's about men who find themselves always marching short of their own and everyone else's expectation, including the readers. But Mr. Barnes says that title has too many words in it. No matter. Stratford has mailed a check for $200, an advance payment upon royalties to be received, and if they can find the paper, they mean to print up copies by the thousand. A terrifying miracle. These words were all written in dark, quiet rooms. How can they face the bright, noisy world? You must know. You open your skin and pour yourself on a canvas. And then let the curators drape your intestines all around the halls for the ruckus of society gossips. Can it be survived? Your friend, Soli. April 13th, 1945. Roosevelt is dead. The end came out of a clear sky. Pen in his hand one moment, then dropped to the floor as his secretary watched. It must have been like seeing Lev's bright light go out. Truly, this is like the death of Lenin. A personality fused with the national purpose struck down by a cerebral stroke, leaving his nation's purpose standing in its shirt sleeves, wondering what under heaven to do. All last night in South Asheville, a crowd stood along the tracks in the cold, hoping to see the catafalque and coffin inside the lighted car when the cortege passed through. The president could only get to Washington from Warm Springs, they thought, by passing through our valley. But no train came. The News Extra this morning said the route was through Greenville. But some still wait, mostly women with children. In a valley east of Otine, they say 100 Negro women clearing tobacco ground have been kneeling since yesterday with hands outstretched toward the railroad track. They won't go home. And now Harry Truman has taken the oath in his polka-dot tie. He hardly looks the part of man fused with the national purpose. He told the newsmen, "Did you ever have a bull or a load of hay fall on you? If you ever did, you know how I felt last night." Sometimes history cleaves and for one helpless moment stands still, like the pause when the axe splits a log and the two halves rest on end, waiting to fall. Lev used to say that. So it was after Lenin died, Lev riding his train toward the Caucasus, unaware the axe had fallen on his friend, that Stalin was mounting the funeral platform to capture the panicked crowds. This may be one of those times again, when history moves toward darkness or light. Which face in the newsprint photographs now conceals treachery? Are tyrants working behind blackout shades, sending a false cable to someone on a train, conniving to keep reason at a distance while power makes its move? People are sore afraid, ready to believe anything. May 8, 1945. The world did not end, or if so, for the Germans only. Everyone came outside to hear the fire siren blow at 6:01, signaling midnight in Germany, official end to the firing of weapons. Women in front yards drying their hands on aprons, telling the boys to stop shooting one another with sticks and be still. On Haywood Street, the clerks and grocers closing up shop all stood perfectly still through that moment, the length of the siren, looking up at the sky. The reflected sunset blazed in the glass storefronts behind them. Some put hands over their hearts, and all of them faced east, toward Europe. No one knows what to do with this peace. When the horns went quiet, every person on Haywood, without a word spoken, turned to look the other way. Japan. The neighbor boy, whose name is not Tom Sawyer, but the even more improbable Romulus, picked a strange flower from the Montford Hill woods and brought it here for identification. He says his mother believed it was a bad animal part that should not be touched. But the father said it's a plant. Ask the fellow next door. They suspect me of having an education. We mounted a library expeditionary force and struck out boldly. Victory was ours. Bartram's Flora of the Carolinas had full-color plates of the specimen in question. It is a pink lady's slipper. Romulus was gravely disappointed to hear it. August 20th, 1945. 5 years this day. Since Lev last saw sunlight. Or said the words, my son, the only one ever to do so. His look of mischief when handing over a newly discovered novel. The last fleeting plea over his shoulder before going in with Jackson. Save me from this lad. The white cuffs soaked like bandages, drops of blood falling on white paper. These images have receded, mostly gone, but then one appears, startling as a stranger standing in the corner of a room where you'd thought yourself alone. Memories do not always soften with time. Some grow edges like knives. He should still be living. Murder has the weight of an unpaid debt, death as unfinished business. No room in the house was safe today. The radio, no distraction. Obscenely, it reported a brutal murder in the south of the city, at one of the tanneries. The tea kettle screaming in the kitchen was Natalia saying his name. A sound can transform itself exactly in the brain. The library seemed it might be a safer place, but it was not. Upstairs in the newspaper room, the curled edges of papers lay in deep layers on tables stacked with books. His desk, all those unfinished sentences. The wax cylinders that still hold his voice somewhere. His desk calendar, if it is there, lies open to August 20th, the page he last turned over, with life's full and ordinary expectation. The thought of that brought a crumpling grief, kneeling in the upstairs stacks, waiting for something inside to burst and flood the maple floorboards. Blood seeping darkly between the cracks. Hell is falling from the skies. A reporter for the Times rode in the plane as a witness, wondering at 0 hour whether he should feel sad for what he called the poor devils about to die. he decided no. It was a fair exchange for Pearl Harbor. The Army's plan was to drop this bomb on a different Japanese city that morning. A different set of men and dogs and schoolchildren and mothers, but the thick clouds over that city refused to part. Growing tired of circling and waiting, the bomber pilots flew southward down the channel and chose Nagasaki, thanks to its clear skies. For want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a cloud, the world was lost. Your blood for mine. If not these, then those. War is the supreme mathematics problem. It strains our skulls, yet we work out the sums, believing we have pressed the most monstrous quantities into a balanced equation. September 2, 1945. VJ Day. If a typewriter did not have these two letters, today it would have been a useless object. The newspaper headlines could only have been larger if they'd found a way to write "Japs surrender" down the page lengthwise instead of across the top. Hallelujah, Hirohito has fallen on his knees. During one of the many church victory picnics, a little girl drowned in the Swannanoa. Romulus came over this evening to sit on the porch swing and tell about it, for he was there. The girl in white hair ribbons gone missing, the hours of searching, then finding her on the river's sandy bottom, where the water was not very deep. He told it all, and then was quiet. We could hear music of some celebration still going, all the way from Pack Square. Romulus said he couldn't tell whether it was a good day or a bad one. MacArthur says the great tragedy has ended. We turned on the wireless, and the assured voices seemed to bring the boy back around. This man, MacArthur, rode horses once, cheered on by a pack of boys not much older than Romulus, sometimes playing polo behind the academy, other times commanding bayonets into the breasts of the bonus marchers. "The skies no longer rain death," he said now. "Men walk upright in the sunlight, and the entire world lies quietly at peace." MacArthur claimed he spoke for thousands of silent lips, forever stilled among the jungles and the deep waters of the ocean. But how could he speak for so many silent lips lying blue beneath the water? Little fish are surely pecking at them now, nourished by worlds of misfortune. November 19th. Dear Frida, here is a small gift, my book, just arrived from New York. Mr. Barnes says it will begin turning up in the bookshops by Friday week, but he sent me two with a note, a spare copy for your mother and dad. The cover art is quite something, as you'll see, with the twin temples of Tlaloc and Huitzilopochtli in the distance. The flames and thinly clad women running from the conquering army should make up for any archaeological inexactness. This format, I was told, worked well for Gone with the Wind. No one here knows of my impending status as a published author. The neighbor ladies find me suspiciously lacking in ambition or family. Miss Atwood still rings up. Few soldiers are home yet, so she makes do with nothing new. Last week, we went to a restaurant called Buck's, opened recently to wild enthusiasm, which wraps up your meal like parcel post and sends it out to the gravel car park while you wait. The idea is to picnic inside your auto, staring at other strangers with catsup on their chins and napkins draped on the steering wheels. You would bawl. It is called a drive-in. Now we can buy gasoline, food, and soon we'll have new autos, too. Why not make use of all at once? The war's end has left America with loads of get-up-and-go and no place to send it. Also, war bond cash saved and nothing to spend it on. Unless we need hollow lead tubing and field combat boots, as that's what the factories are geared for making. We still use ration stamps for almost everything. Truman is trying to keep price controls on until shortages abate, but the manufacturers can smell hoarded cash. They're parading ad men through Congress to convince the lawmakers that free market is the way to go and that Harry Truman is in league with Karl Marx. The neighbor ladies here are firm on the side of Harry and Karl Marx. They know price controls are the only thing standing between ourselves and the $20 steak. I confess to an unpatriotic yearning to buy a refrigerator. But if a Philco showed up in town now without its OPA ration tag, it would go to Mrs. Vanderbilt for the cost of my mortgage. Meanwhile, the husbands concoct a black market with more plot twists than the Codex Botturini. Romulus, my young informant, reports his dad went to the car dealers to finagle a new Ford, not yet legally for sale. He was told if he bought the salesman's dog for $800, they would give him a free car to drive the pup home. Romulus cheered, but he was in it for the dog. One thing can be had without a stamp, though, and that's my book. Please feel no moral duty to read it. You've done enough. Only look for the dedication page, where you'll see a familiar name. I apologize for the title. Mr. Barnes says Vassals of Majesty sounds like a book people want to read, and it's his business to know. What would you do if a museum curator said your paintings should be hung on both sides with pink organdy curtains? Oh, yes, I remember. You would poke him in the eye with a paintbrush and tell him to hang organdy curtains over his dog's ass face. Lacking your courage, I avoid disagreements with the company that buys my bread and butter, and possibly a Philco. I am getting on fine, with no complaints at all about my new country, except that it has no olives worth eating and no peppers fit for adults. This package holds the proof of my incomprehensible good fortune. Use it at the bottom of your door to stop a draft, and know that I am your grateful friend, H. W. Shepherd, author. December 5th. The first snow of the season fell today on 200 women standing in a queue on Haywood Street after an announcement that nylon stockings would be available one per customer at Ray's department store. One block down at the bookshop, a single copy of Vassals of Majesty was handled by several different customers in the course of the morning. Each conducted a close inspection of the Indian maids fleeing through flames on the dust jacket. No lines formed on the sidewalk. No Philco this year. Kingsport News, January 12, 1946. Book Review by United Press. The modern reader complains that theatrics have all gone to the movies. Where is the old-fashioned barn burner to carry us away? Here is one to fit the bill. Harrison Shepherd's Vassals of Majesty, Stratford & Sons, $2.39, tells of a golden age when Spanish conquistadors fought for the New World. Cortez plays out as a winning villain, lining his pockets in the name of church and queen while paying no heed to the trials endured by his men. The weak-minded Emperor Montezuma makes hardly a better impression, doting on his captive birds while his bloodthirsty chiefs do their worst. The princes in this story are the common soldiers, pushed to the limits but revealing true humanity. The story's droll assertion, heroes may be less than heroic, while the common man saves the day. The Evening Post, January 18, 1946. Books for Thought by Sam Hall Mitchell. Gee, but I want to go home. If you're weary of the military tribunals of Goering and Hess, their grisly details dragging on, try this one on for size. Chieftains who cut out the hearts of war prisoners while still beating. The year is 1520. The place, a glittering city on a lake where the last Aztec emperor meets his mortal enemy, Cortez. The book is Vassals of Majesty, a plush first effort from author Harrison Shepherd. Swords clash on every page in this clever retelling of the conquest of Mexico's richest empire. Greed and vengeance drive the action, but the novel's tender theme is a longing for home. The Spanish royalty cry out for gold, but the young men forced into battle only wish for better shoes in a prickling desert and something better to cook than cactus pads on a campfire. These soldiers might as well be singing the song every GI knows by heart. The coffee that they give us, they say, is mighty fine. It's good for cuts and bruises, and it tastes like iodine. While leaders plot the fate of golden cities, these soldiers worry they'll lose the wife to another fellow while they're far from home. In a nation of returning soldiers and war-weary civilians, this book will make a huge emotional mark. The Asheville Trumpet, February 3, 1946. Asheville Writer is Story of the Year, by Carl Nicholas. Vassals of Majesty, by local wordsmith Harrison Shepherd, proves nothing short of sheer fascination. It might seem only stuffed shirts and long-haired professors would clamor to read of men living hundreds of years ago. Not so! Every heart will pound as Conqueror Cortez pitches battle against his foe. This book has it all, blood-curdling treachery and even heart interest. The female pulse will race for handsome Indian Prince Cuautla. With the speed of a locomotive, the story hurtles to its epic conclusion. Mrs. Jack Cates, owner of Cates Bookshop, confirms she cannot keep it on the shelves. Asheville's very own Harrison Shepherd is a young man of only 30, holding the secrets of the ages in his pen. Calls to the home confirmed he resides in Montford Hills. Young ladies, take note. Our sources say he's a bachelor. The New York Weekly Review, February 2, 1946. Vassals of Majesty, by Harrison W. Shepherd, Stratford and Sons, New York. Never Far From Home, by Michael Reed. In the literary season of Anna's beleaguered King of Siam and Teddy Roosevelt's unterrified grab of Panama, a nation at peace seems keen for tales of exotic foreign conflict. Readers will find rich fodder in this novel of shrewd ambition in the bloody Spanish conquest of Mexico. Narrating the tale are Cuautla, an heir to the Aztec Empire, and Lieutenant Remedios, who must execute the commands of notorious empire builder Hernando Cortez. History buffs are warned. Scarcely a hero in this tale survives with reputation intact. Cortez shows a weakness for Mexican liquor and cares more about his page in history than the men who give their lives to write it for him. And the sweet-natured, delusional Emperor Moctezuma leaves most of the decisions to a ruthless cadre whose protocol for handling war prisoners may cause the reader a night of lost sleep. From its snappy title onward, this is a potboiler with no real aspirations to literary importance. The exaggerated setting of blood-stained temples and battlements seems to flutter with the tags of a Hollywood film set. But the characters threaten to burst from their archetypes. The humblest have a winning way of striving for honor in duty, while the powerful fall prey to familiar political failures, revealing themselves as ordinary men all, not so different from the modern-day elected official or office clerk. The author suggests no disagreement among men is ever entirely foreign, after all. A sample of reviews sent by the publisher's clipping service, 12 in all, January to February 1946. March 10, 1946. Dear Frida, thank you for the box of chiles. A spectacular surprise. I've strung them in a red ristra for the kitchen alongside the onions I plait and hang near the stove. The neighbor boy suspects me of harboring spells, but Perpetua would approve of my kitchen. I will ration these pasillas de Oaxaca like anything, dearer than gasoline. Our Carolina shows signs of spring. Crocuses appear in front lawns. Long wool underwear vanishes from clotheslines in the back. Yesterday, I brought a frozen lamb shank from the butcher's and set it in the flower box outside the window to keep it chilled overnight. This morning, it had completely thawed. Today, I will rub it with garlic for an impromptu feast. The cat Chispa spreads the word of my erratic cooking extravagances around the neighborhood, and now another scoundrel has followed her home. I call him Chisme for the gossip that brought him. Black as the devil and fond of lamb. Soon my shanks may get to visit an authentic Philco. The publisher's accountants are preparing a royalty check for the first 50,000 copies of the book. You can't imagine what you set loose on the world with one quick job of paper smuggling. I have to run a gauntlet when leaving the house. Two young ladies are out there now, lollygagging on the front walk in saddle shoes and rolled-up dungarees, reporters for a school newspaper from the look of them, or just autograph hounds, sucked in by the bizarre and rampant rumors that I am a person of interest. Even my neighbors brought over a book for autograph. It was wrapped up as if they meant to give it a state burial or else cure it for a ham. Romulus says he spotted some girls slipping around the back to steal my shirts off the clothesline and chased them off by what he calls whooping and hollowing. I am abashed by this admiration, for it seems directed at some other person. How these girls would hoot if they saw me as I really am, cowering indoors on wash days, festooning the bathroom with my damp ball brigands so they won't be stolen or made the subject of a theme paper in senior English. My new life. No one has said I eat human flesh in a tortilla, but I'm getting an idea how your lives have been disfigured all these years by gossip. I can't answer the telephone, for it's sure to be a newspaper man asking questions. Place of birth, status of bowels. I don't know what to do with this havoc. I learned today by mail about the publisher's check. Mr. Barnes tried all week to reach me, unaware I was hiding from the telephone. Soon I'll have to do something about the mail. The box fills daily with notes from readers. 7 proposals of marriage so far. Such a query requires a gentle response, but I'll confess I'm flummoxed. I've had no practice in the skills of being admired. Frida, sometimes an acid panic rises in my throat. People want something, and I am not the thing at all. As I've mentioned, girls are desperate, with the fellows still over there patching up the potholes in France. Poor England and France. Their great kingdoms, nothing now but fairy tales. Did El Diario mention Churchill's speech last week in Missouri? The European leaders seem terrified by the new landscape, flattened at the middle, with Truman still on his feet at one end and Stalin at the other. You could see why Mr. Churchill wants to keep them from shaking hands. If Harry and Comrade Joe reach across that mess, these two could make a new empire on which the sun never sets. Mr. Churchill sounded like a child goading his parents into an argument. He was absurdly dramatic.
A shadow has fallen upon the scene. Nobody knows what Soviet Russia intends to do, etc.
Next, he will probably go to Moscow and say the same about us. How strange that this is the wide-open moment Lev spent his life hoping for. With America brimming with brotherly love for the Soviets, our own laborers on the march, and Russia with everything to gain, it seems the right time to support them in tossing out Stalin's bureaucrats and finishing the democratic socialist revolution as Lenin intended. Or it could go the other way, our two nations falling apart like split kindling. Mr. Churchill seems to want that. From the Baltic to the Adriatic, he said, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. He sweetened the pot later with goodwill for the valiant Russians and Comrade Stalin. But the howlers went right to work as soon as they heard of this strange new curtain of metal. They are thrilled with the image. The cartoonists draw the poor Russians slamming their heads against an anvil. Probably in a fortnight they'll have forgotten it, but for now it's a sensation. Two words put together, curtain and iron, have worked alchemy on a kettle of tepid minds and anxious hearts. The power of words is awful, Frida. Sometimes I want to bury my typewriter in a box of quilts. The radio makes everything worse, because of the knack for amplifying dull sounds. Any two words, spoken in haste, might become law of the land. But you never know which two. You see why I won't talk to the newsmen. My dread is sometimes inexplicable. How do you bear up under so many eyes? And what ludicrous worries I have compared with yours. I hope the bone graft operation you mention will make your life worth living again. I worry for your weariness, but trust in your strength, and often see your paintings in my dreams. Your friend, H. W. Shepherd. P.S. I enclose a review to clear up any mistaken notions you may have about my novel. The Echo, February 28, 1946. This one is flying off the bookstore shelves from coast to coast. Vassals of Majesty by Harrison W. Shepherd, with 50,000 sold the first month after publication. Its pageant of noble heroes and dastardly villains plays out on the golden shores of ancient Rome. When you've had enough of the heart and soul of the common man, exalted by the late FDR, here are uncommon men with derring do, sweeping the reader into the success dream that drives them. Ladies and gentlemen, but definitely, Harry Shepherd cranks out a darn good read. And watch out, girls, he's single. March 13, 1946. Dear Shepherd, what's steamin', demon? Remember me from civilian service? Nobody forgets this tomcat. Hope you're all the aces since last we soldiered together for art and country. Everywhere I go now, some guy is just home from Europe telling how he dodged the lead pill or brought in his bomber on a wing and a prayer. Does anybody want to hear a hair-raising tale of army snafu in the National Gallery? You and me, buddy, a couple of civvy cream puffs. It's a void coupon, ain't it? If only my old chum Shepherd were here, we could tell some war stories, sure. How you and I drank so much Joe on the train, we almost dropped a marble Rodin on its head at the Asheville station. Man, you could have had me for soup when I saw your name in the book review. Is that you or some other Harrison Shepherd? I didn't have you figured for the Shakespeare type, but who knows? If it's really you, drop a line. Plant you now, dig you later, Tom Cuddy. March 29th, 1946. Dear Shepherd, Holy Joe, it's really you. Thanks for the buzz. Cat, you know how to percolate. With everything you are currently hip to, this will probably sound like cake and coffee, but a proposition has come up and I figure I'll give it a sock. The Department of State is getting into the art business. It's not enough that chumps like us packed off America's treasures to the Vanderbilt mansion and back to keep them safe from Tojo. Now the idea is to pack up a fresh load of paintings on Uncle Sam's ticket and parade them around the museums of Europe. A special show of American painters to send overseas to show those Parisians were not a bunch of rubes. Somebody spilled the beans to the Department of State that the Europeans hate us. Surprise! Jean-Pierre thinks G.I. Joe is a slob with chocolate on his face. Between you and me, I doubt the Parisians care as long as we keep putting the bricks back in their castles. But the Congress cares. They are convoying this ship and aim to blitz it. Here's where you and I come in. They recruited my old boss for the job, Leroy Davidson from the Walker. He only got 50,000 clams to work with, but he's done a killer job. Leroy chose everything himself. He's fed up with the Europeans snickering about heart-throbbing landscapes and the American scene, so he decided to give them an eyeful. 79 paintings, mostly modern art. Stuart Davis, Marsden Hartley, Georgia O'Keeffe, it's a killer. Even Goodrich at the Whitney says so. We're hanging it here in New York for the summer, and then it moves to the National for a few weeks. Leroy says Congress needs to see what American art looks like before we send it off. That's the story, Morning Glory. You'd come to D.C. in October. You're already on the State Department's cleared list. Leroy says we can hire you in a tick to help with the crating and get this show ready for Transatlantic. If you want, you can even come along for the ride. The war's over, pal. This time we would go first class, not steerage. No more riding on top of our wooden crates in the train car, which really was not half a bad place to lob around, as it turned out. Like Hope says, thanks for the memories. But think of it, man. You and me in Europe. Goose feather beds. What a gasser. Sounds like you might be cooking with gas already in your present situation. But give me a buzz if you are ready to take Paris. So long, chum. Tom Cuddy. April 3rd, 1946. Dear Frida, your letter arrived yesterday and now lies open on the desk, a specter burning at its edges. This damage is not yours. You aren't the cause. It's a normal and ordinary request for a friend to come and visit in New York when you are there for the bone graft surgery. A friend who owes you everything and might now smuggle Rellenos into the hospital to speed your recovery. Who should do this? But no sleep came last night, only thoughts in a night-long darkness of the summer coming, a ride on the train, the penetrating glare of strangers, imposing on your fashionable friends in New York, these Americans who understand everything, all of it envisioned in a cold panic. This is a despicable confession. But one telephone call yesterday to the train station to ask about a ticket was enough to drag a stomach inside out. Dejado de la mano de Dios, left alone by God, this feeling. Abandoned by reason or safety. Perched on the side of the bathtub, rocking like a child, hopeless, wishing for the invisibility of childhood. August of each year brings thoughts of dying. But bad days come in any month. Eyes can pierce a skull. Travel to New York is unthinkable, when even at the corner market, a stranger's stare can paralyze. This terror hasn't any name. This running home, feeling like a scorched muslin curtain that blew too near the candle. Forgive this cowardice. If you have the strength to lift your head as you travel down Fifth Avenue, look for one book in the shop windows there, standing in as a substitute for your once and future friend, Soli. The Asheville Trumpet, April 28, 1946. Woman's Club sponsors Book Review Night by Edwina Boudreau. The Asheville Woman's Club sponsored its annual book review night on Thursday at 6 p.m. in the Lee H. Edwards High School auditorium. Tickets sold for 25 cents each, raising $45 for the Asheville Library. The theme of the evening was Mexico, Old and New. Mrs. Herb Lutheridge, president, opened the program with the Pledge of Allegiance and introduction of speakers. Miss Harriet Boudreau began the festivities with her review of The Peacock Sheds His Tail by Alice Hobart. The book concerns the love story of a Mexican girl and American diplomat in the turbulence of unrest in modern-day Mexico City. For her presentation, Miss Boudreau wore native dress of embroidered blouse and skirt, brought from the Mexican continent by her aunt, who traveled there as a bride. The second presenter was welcomed by many excited young ladies in attendance, Mrs. Violet Brown reviewing Vassals of Majesty by Harrison Shepherd. The novel tells the exciting conquest of ancient Mexico by the Spanish army. Events came alive under Mrs. Brown's retelling, followed by a lively discussion. Numerous questions arose concerning the author, an Asheville residing in the Montford neighborhood, which the speaker demurred at, claiming familiarity with the book itself, not its progenitor. In her 45-minute presentation, Mrs. Brown brought to the fore many themes that might be missed by the average reader, such as man against nature and man against himself. Mrs. Alberta Blake, librarian, closed the evening by thanking the audience on behalf of the library committee, noting all money raised would purchase several new volumes. She assured all those in attendance that duplicate copies of the two books presented will soon be on the shelves. April 30th, 1946. Mrs. Violet Brown, 4145 Tunnel Road, Biddle House, Rural Free Delivery, Asheville, North Carolina. Dear Mrs. Brown, this message may startle you. Please forgive a bolt from the blue. A telephone call to Mrs. Biddle yesterday confirmed that the former Guild of Lodgers remains intact, minus myself. She may thus think it improved vis-a-vis her advertisement of only good people here, and that you could therefore be reached by this address. The purpose of this letter is to plant a request. Against all odds, a man who can perform every secretarial duty himself from A to Z, including changing the typewriter ribbon, now seems to be in need of a secretary. A startling ship of fortune has docked in this harbor on Montford Avenue, towing an unwieldy barge of correspondence, telephone calls, and attention from young ladies. It is a wonder how others who become so blessed still manage to go forward with their lives. Mr. Sinatra receives 5,000 letters a week, according to the Echo, and he still looks the picture of high spirits. Only 100 or so come here each week, but they fall like mounds of autumn leaves, leaving the spirits damp and crawling with nervous beetles. What is to be done? An old friend who recently telephoned, a fellow who also worked at the National Gallery during the war, proposed, "Lace up your boots, Jive Cat, and requisition yourself a canary to be your stenographer." After translating this advice into my own tongue, the question remained, where does one requisition such a canary? Then on Sunday, your name rose up boldly, Mrs. Brown, in the Asheville Trumpet. There you stood with my book in hand, facing down a riotous crowd at the Woman's Club Gala. Applying the same calm efficiency you used for handling Mrs. Biddle and her everlasting muddles, keeping your steady hand on the tiller, you guided the book night toward the deep waters of literary theme, quieting the commotion of Miss Boudreau in her get-up from the Mexican continent. The ladies pressed for details of the author himself, but you professed no knowledge of such person. Imagine the fracas if you had revealed the truth, that you and the author had once lived under the same roof with a landlady who sometimes mixed our laundry together. Mrs. Brown, dear lady, your discretion is prodigious. You resisted the siren song of tattle. The seams of your character must be sewn with steel thread. If this letter delivers only my everlasting gratitude, that is a greater weight than 3 cents postage should allow. But it also contains an earnest query. Your conduct in the battle of Mexico Old and New has led me to think you may be just the amanuensis who could put a life to rights and also help with typing a second book, now underway. Naturally, you may have a different opinion. Let me sum up a few details and be finished so you can consider the offer. Weighing in my favor, I hope. I am likely in a position to exceed your present salary. A drawback. My workplace is here where I live. Some ladies might find it awkward to work in the home of an unmarried gentleman. In this letter, I have already used the terms cat and canary, not because I could ever think of a secretary in those terms, but because others do, evidently. Mrs. Brown, I have an odd impairment. The world paints its prejudices boldly across banners, and somehow I walk through them without seeing. It's a particular fault of mine, a blindness. I carry on walking down the street, dazed as a calf, with shreds of paper hanging everywhere. I hope in this case to be less naive. A final point in my favor. I spent years as a stenographer myself, as I already hinted. In Mexico, I worked for two different men, both greater than I will ever be. Oddly, the experience did not prepare me for public attention. But I understand the role of professional helpmeet, perhaps better than most men. I am not disposed to tyranny. If anything about this request strikes you as unseemly, please ignore it and accept my high regard for our previous acquaintance. But if my suggestion holds interest for you, I would gladly schedule an interview at a date and time you suggest. Sincerely, Harrison W. Shepherd. May 4th, 1946. Dear Mr. Shepherd, your letter was what you said, a bolt from the blue, but not the first. At the lending library, I saw your name on a book cover in January. My thought was, well, sir, it's a coincidence there be two Harrison Shepherds in this world. Next, an article in the paper discussed the book, its author reputed to be living in Montfort. The subject of Mexico I knew to be your familiar. Curiosity killed the cat for Miss Biddle. Her niece said she'd spied on the fellow, reporting him tall as a tree and thin as a rail. Who else? Imagine our surprise. For years we sat here like bumps on a log, eating the cooking of a man who would shortly come to fame. Now, old Mr. Judd says, I had no idea what that young fellow was cooking. You remember his drear jokes. Miss McKellar notes that still waters run deep. Reg Borden still refuses to believe it's you, but wants to read the book anyway. He's had a long wait. The library has but one copy. I had to wait weeks myself, and I have an in with Miss Luthridge since I joined the library committee, mainly to set the card files to rights, which were a disgrace. Your book is good. This town hasn't had such a sensation since Tommy Wolfe came out with Look Homeward, Angel. And that sensation was not pleasing to most. Some in Asheville were disgruntled to be left out of the story, and all others dismayed to be left in. Thus the scandal was entire. The library refused to carry it. I was already in the Woman's Club, recording secretary, and our meeting convened the week that book came out. I doubt if so many salts of ammonia have ever been used in our city, before or since. You had only to open the door of the meeting hall to get a mighty dose. I couldn't guess how to write a book, but here is my opinion. People love to read of sins and errors, just not their own. You were wise to put your characters far from here, instead of so-called Altamont, as Mr. Wolfe did. That Dixieland is his mother's boarding house on Spruce Street, and all here know it. Few were spared the jabs of Wolfe's pen, even his own father, whom I myself can remember teetering into the S&W cafeteria reeking of spirits before noon of a Monday. Many feel there was no need to bring that kind of thing to the limelight, especially by a family member. This all pertains to the subject of your letter. Thank you for saying I am sewn up with steel thread, but I call it plain sense. Some writers get away with murder, using nice words and a mannerly story to bring misery on real folk. You did the other way, writing of murderous things, but behaving as a gentleman in the civic sense. That's how I came to speak as I did at book review night. Those girls were apoplectic to make your book into another hometown yarn. We've had that kind of yarn here, and it got itself wound up in a gorm of knots. Mr. Shepherd, you put your story in Mexico. Why not keep it there? That was my thinking. I know you as a gentleman. Using your home as a place of employment is not unseemly. A lady in the working world all her life knows that tender manners have their place, sometimes less useful than a good cup of coffee. During the war, secretaries sometimes emptied bedpans, and certain men will ask worse, even in peacetime. But knowing you as I do from Ms. Biddle's, I've seen you show more kindness than most, even toward a hand you're fixing to put in the oven. I will warn, I can be particular. I like a typewriter with an automatic margin and the type bar separate from the carriage, preferably a Royal or L.C. Smith. These were used at the Selective Service office, and I got accustomed. I will come to your house for interviewing at 6:30 on Thursday. The neighborhood of your address is a short ride on the bus from my present employer. I'll go directly after work. Sincerely, Violet Brown. May 27th. Mother's soul can rest. Here is a woman in my life. Mrs. Brown in a pearl gray snood, age 46, sensible as pancake flour. Like characters in a story, our lives were star-crossed but came together. She will rescue the hero, answer his telephone, file the mountains of mail, maybe shake a broom at the laundry thieves. And he can keep his monk's life, the holes in his underwear. Mrs. Brown doesn't care. At the first interview, she laid her failings at my feet, or would have, except she hasn't any. Does not smoke cigarettes, take strong drink, go to church, or gamble. Has worked for the city, the army, and most daunting of all, the Asheville Woman's Club. 30 years a widow. She doubts being married would have been much different. It was strange to speak forthrightly after living at Mrs. Biddle's those years, exiting the bathroom with downcast eyes, sitting at supper while old Mr. Judd piped up with his yellowed news extras. Now it seems we shared a kindred silence, restraining our smiles on hearing that Limburger has flown across the Atlantic. But maybe I contrived this, as lovers reconfigure the days before, with every glance leading ultimately to union. In any event, here she is, installed in my dining room. I hated to show her the mail, stored in bushel baskets in the empty spare bedroom. She did not flinch. Grasped each bushel by the handles, marched it downstairs, and dumped onto the maple table one mountain for each month. Bravely she dives in, even before we've found her a filing cabinet or acceptable typewriter, Royal or L.C. Smith. We shall put the bathroom door back on its hinges as soon as I've cleared its surface of all piles and chapters and found a proper desk myself. For now, when one of us needs the WC, the other steps out the back door, pretending to call the cats. This and more she suffers with perfect composure. Mrs. Brown is a force. Small, unadorned, unapologetic. Her eyebrows arch like a pair of bridges across her wide forehead. Her blouse is buttoned to the top. She wears white cotton gloves even on warm days, and she can still any troubled waters with her austere calm and peculiar antique grammar. Each morning, on arrival, she taps on the front door, puts in her head, and calls out, "Mr. Shepherd, where be ye?" Her words seem scripted by Chaucer. She says striped and learned, making an extra syllable of the past tense. A sack is a poke. Surveying the piles of letters, she declared, "Mr. Shepherd, you get mail by the passel." She says not and nary a one, and the garden greens she brought me were sallets, the word Shakespeare used. She says queasy to mean worried, as did King Lear. When I noted this, she replied, "Well, I expect he had a lot to be queasy about. He was a king, wasn't he?" When pressed about her origins, she said her people were mountain whites. She seemed reluctant to say more, only that it means Highlanders, people who came through the gap from England ages ago and reckoned they ought to stay, remaining on the spot with idiom intact. She means reckon in the British sense, akin to reconnoiter, until knowing a thing for certain, which is to ken it. Most shocking was this pronouncement. "My family be there still, living in a cabin home in the hills." This is a kind of bush, evidently, a rhododendron. She said, "They grow thick as can be. If you came to be lost in there, you couldn't push out with a stick. So it's called hills. Pardon if you're offended. It isn't a foul word in that sense." No offense taken. Her past can stay where it is, lost in the hells. Not my business, as my childhood hells are none of hers. We concern ourselves with the future, which we agreed should begin at once, in my dining room, as soon as she could give proper notice. And today here she is, dispatching the mess with carbon paper and a buttoned-up smile.